Miller Park, and the White Sox host the Indians again tonight down at the Cell. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish lost to the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters 8-1 last night. The two teams meet again tonight at Simmons Field at 6:35. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, June 13th. Sunny and warm, today's high 79. Tonight, clear and mild, a low of 55. Tomorrow, Thursday, sunny and 80. New numbers in, 72 in Racine, 71 in Kenosha. Wind from the west-northwest at 12, humidity 81%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. With Father's Day not too far in the future, I am really excited to be able to share with you this interview with David McGlynn, a very, very talented writer who is on the faculty at Lawrence University up in Appleton, the author of a number of fine books, some of which have been award-winning books, and his latest is called One Day You'll Thank Me, Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. In this book, David McGlynn talks about all kinds of different experiences that he has had as a father, and woven in along the way a few experiences of his as a son of his own father, and an interesting relationship that the two of them had. But mostly this is about the pleasures and perils of being the father of two very energetic boys, Galen and Hayden. And it is one of the very best books of its kind that I have ever read. It's published by Counterpoint, and I'm very excited about the next few minutes about this opportunity to speak with David McGlynn. Again, his book is titled One Day You'll Thank Me. And David McGlynn, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited. I love your book, and I hope a lot of people are going to seek it out and enjoy it. Ahead of us talking about the book, could you just say a quick word about your own love of writing, love of language, and maybe where some of that came from?
You know, it's always hard to pinpoint where it comes from, but I have been writing for a really long time. You know, now that my kids are in school, and they've been to school, you know, for many years, it's easy to sort of get nostalgic and look back and then remember your own self as a student. And I can go all the way back to first and second grade when I wrote stories. And I've loved to read, and even I think more than reading, I love to noodle around with language. There was a moment, for example, in One Day You'll Thank Me where I talk about, in a different context, standing in my backyard, puzzling over over weird words, you know, and sometimes the most ordinary words, if you say them enough times or you say them in sort of weird context, they start to sound really strange. And for me, that word was shovel. For reasons I can't really explain, I would stand in my backyard and think, what a weird word shovel is. As that sort of grows, you know, as time goes on, and you find yourself sort of thinking about language and thinking about sentences, you know, one thing leads to another, and I start to tell more stories. And then as, you know, I move into college and after that, it's just a lot of doing it again and again. You know, if you want to get good at something, you do it a million times, and eventually it pays off.
Hmm. Could you say a word about writing this particular book, about it being such a personal book in which you seem to be sharing in fairly unbridled fashion all kinds of experiences from your own family's life, including the lives of your two boys. What did that feel like to be sharing all of this with the world? And did you have any hesitancy about that?
Yeah, you know, those are all really great questions. So this book is my third. The book that comes before it is a memoir titled A Door in the Ocean, which is about a very sort of personal experience with a very violent crime that happened when I was a kid in Houston, Texas, which is where I grew up. And that memoir, which appeared in 2012, was a really difficult experience to write, in large part because I had to get so personal and talk about myself in such sort of open and intimate ways. However, having done that, it's sort of like I sort of broke the seal, you know, and once you realize that you can write about yourself and put your dirty laundry out on the line and the sky isn't going to fall, you begin to see, or at least I began to see, all kinds of other possibilities. And right about the time that A Door in the Ocean was getting finished, that I was about finished with it, I decided to take a break and write a short piece that I originally imagined would appear like on the radio or in a magazine, something just sort of funny, someplace sort of short. And I sort of had this idea for a story about how my father every year would give us the world's worst Christmas presents. And I don't mean that he like couldn't get your size right or he didn't know your favorite color. You know, he would give us really horrible, horrible Christmas presents. And when I was in college, for example, I would get a sleeve of spaghetti and a jar of tomato sauce. You know, and that'd be Christmas. To this day, he sends us a box of stuff that he finds in the lost and found at the pool and stuff he's picked out of garage sales. And then comes this big box of junk that shows up at my front door. And it's become kind of a gag. But growing up, there was something that was sort of painful about it, especially after my parents got divorced. You know, I didn't get to see my dad as much as I wanted to. I had to sort of endure, like, not only missing him, but then also these really cruddy presents. So I decided to write this story, and I did. And in the process, it made me laugh. Because, you know, I had this sort of sentimental emotion, but then when you really started to lay out all the weird things I'd gotten over the years, you know, one time he gave me a big baggie full of spare change, you know, pocket calculators that were 10 years old, I mean, just junk after junk. The story that sort of came was funny, and it was also kind of heartwarming, and it sort of showed me something about my family, and it showed me something about how to tell a story about the kids. And so I started sniffing around for other stories that I might be able to tell. And as I started to pay attention to things that were going on with my family, with my wife, with my relationship with my dad now that I'm an adult, with my relationship to the boys as they were starting school and moving through school, all kinds of other possibilities began to show themselves. And so I would just pay attention and I would try to write them down and try to understand, you know, how they might be teaching me something. In most cases, what I was finding is that I would screw something up and I could only really learn after I made some initial error. And then once I would go back and sort of have to unwind my own mistake, then you know, here comes the possibility of some kind of, you know, lesson or redemption or closeness or something like that. So in terms of, you know, exposing myself or exposing the family, most of it seemed easier than I had done in the past because it was sort of more lighthearted. And you know, there's nothing better than screwing something up and then figuring it out. And that often became the sort of conceit by which the book operates. Here's where I screw it up, and here's where I figure it out. And by figuring it out, we sort of slowly find our way to a more intimate, more aware, more thoughtful and intelligent relationship as a family, but also a sort of more nuanced dance towards what it means to be a dad in general.
One of your best lines or most intriguing lines in the very first chapter of the book is when you say, "Fatherhood, as I've come to understand it, is an endlessly moving target, especially when it comes to boys." And you also say, especially now, at this juncture in America. I want to ask you about the second part, but first talk about that initial thing, fatherhood as an endlessly moving target, especially when it comes to boys. Explain what you're saying there.
Well, okay, yeah, that's another really great question. You know, first of all, you know, the world is really full of parenting and life advice, right? There are probably as many parenting books as there are diet books and the sort of fad diet plans, you know. Everywhere you look, you can find someone willing to say, here's what you ought to do in order to parent your children correctly or most healthily or whatever. And all of those are well-intentioned, but they often sort of miss out on the larger and more problematic fact that you're dealing with human beings, you know, and children are predictable in some ways, but most unpredictable in most other ways, because they're little humans, you know, and they're discovering the world as they go. And so just when you think you understand how something is supposed to work, how you're supposed to do things in the right way. And I guess I should say, I really feel like most parents, one way or another, are trying to do right by their kids. You know, they don't see parenting as some sort of mechanistic process that they're just trying to sort of plug into. They're trying to respond to their kids and respond to their families as they see them. But the moment you think you've got something sorted, or you have some principle, some piece of advice, some idea that's going to sort of govern how you live, your kids will come along and disrupt that. And just when they sort of figure out the thing that you really care about, they also figure out a way to disrupt whatever that thing is, because they see an opening in some way to change it or to get something that they want or to sort of assert themselves or assert their identities. So, you know, you're sort of always on the lookout for those moments where it's going to sort of, the ground's going to shift beneath you, you know. And when it comes to boys, you know, and I think that more and more writers are paying attention to this question, the problem of being a boy in 2018 is that we're not always so sure what to do with them anymore. These sort of older models of boys always as sort of playing sports or growing up to be masculine and in certain sort of prescripted ways, you know, physical, you know, their relationships to women, to sort of sexuality as a larger topic, even when they're young, to heroism, to valor, to sort of physical assertions. All those things are lately becoming questioned, and personally, I would say probably with good reason. And you know, now that we've seen sort of the questions and the problems of masculinity brought more into to the forefront, you know, the questions of how does one parent a boy isn't quite so easy anymore. You know, you want to help them grow. You want to help them become good people. You want to help them sort of deal with all the sort of energy that they have and all the sort of impulse that they have to be, you know, physical and to wrestle on the lawn. But at the same time, not necessarily fall into some of the older traps and cliches that haven't always been so healthy.
Right. You write at one point, men, manliness, and masculinity have been the subject of major reconsiderations in the years since my boys joined the world. So in other words, you are fathering boys at a time that is, in a sense, much more complicated than it was, say, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago when the lines of distinction were cleaner, and a lot of these tough questions just weren't being asked. A little later in that same paragraph, you say, I want to do right by my sons. I want them to grow into strong and courageous young men, confident and successful adults. What parent wants any less? Yet there's a fine line between strength and chauvinism, confidence and arrogance. You're really touching on something profound there, that it is so hard to know where that line is, and how can you as the father help your sons know where that line is?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a really nice observation, so thank you for touching on that. You know, I've talked in the course of writing, you know, I sometimes, in addition to writing this book and sort of other books, I write articles for magazines and newspapers. And so I've had conversations with researchers specifically about this question, you know, as a sort of companion to working on this book. And more than one psychologist and more than one sociologist has said that, you know, the discussion about femininity and feminism has really expanded in a sort of fertile way, you know, that we sort of more and more encourage women to think about themselves, and young girls and young women to think about themselves as breaking out of the categories of femininity that they had been previously confined by. The weird thing about that is that it often leaves boys feeling all the more sort of confined into these sort of narrower definitions of what it means to be a boy, you know. And on one hand, right, some of those things are, you know, they don't strike me as necessarily all that problematic or harmful or even bad. You know, my boys are, as you mentioned, like really energetic, you know, and so we need to find some way to channel that. And there's something good about being energetic, right? It's vital. It's healthy. It's a sort of virility that sort of moves forth into the world. But the other side of it is you can end up sort of slotted into some of these older gendered confinements. And how do we help them sort of be their best selves, but not be the sort of darker or bad version of that? And I would say that that's, you know, it's a nuanced project that I think every father and mother, every sort of parent of a young boy, probably has to undertake one way or another, right? And I try to see that project as delightful in its way, because you get to watch these little people grow. But that doesn't mean it's not without seriousness and it's not without concern. So I've tried to pay attention as best I could.
You know, I was going to ask you about this later in the interview, but some of what you're talking about is prompting me to kind of jump ahead to this. One of my favorite moments in the book is when you are trying to help one of your sons through really kind of a difficult choice about whether or not to keep up with a sport in which he is really struggling. The chapter is called The Q Word. And
that's
I think it's your son, Galen. And one of the things we should probably toss out here is that you were a championship swimmer as a young man, and swimming is still important to you. And I think early on, Galen engaged in swimming, much to your delight, I'm sure. But
that's
then
right.
At some point, he gave that up for another sport. And began to really struggle, and the new sport was basketball. Just tell our listeners a little bit about what I'm talking about, and the really kind of tough situation in which you found yourself as Galen's father in trying to help him make the best choice for himself regarding basketball.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, like I was, and I still am to this day, a swimmer. And so sports has been important to me, not just because I cared about sports, but because I really value the sort of benefits of physical activity. You know, one of the sort of primary ways that I have always kind of calmed down, thought out the problems of of whatever I'm working on has been to go to the pool, you know, and I sort of swim it out. And I believe it makes our body stronger. It makes our circulatory systems healthier. It's good for the, you know, soul and the brain and all those kinds of things. And so seeing my own sons grow and become these sort of large, tall, energetic young men, like sports was always something that we sort of counted on. You know, they were something that they were going to do. And Galen, you know, has tried a number of them over the years, and he loves to play sports, but he hasn't always loved the competition, you know. And so he did swimming for a while, and that went pretty well, and he enjoyed it, and he certainly likes going to the water and being in the pool, and he's very comfortable in the water. But he didn't really love the competition as quite as much. It sort of made him anxious. So then, you know, he goes into elementary school, and he's sort of going through the years, and he's getting toward the end and about to start junior high. And because of his height, he's the tallest in his class by a lot. You know, basketball seemed like a really natural fit. In the first couple of seasons that he played, you know, we just were sort of playing at the YMCA, and it was pretty non-competitive. I could tell that he liked the court. He liked being with friends. He liked the sort of up-close interaction of basketball. It didn't seem like it was as sort of spread out as soccer or football. You know, he liked the sort of the way the game moved. So one thing leads to another, and he begins to play more and more, and all of a sudden we find ourselves driving all the way to Chicago for games, all the way to Western Wisconsin for games, all the way, you know, all over the state for these big tournaments. And I begin to notice that old anxiety about competition and just a general sense of unhappiness is really creeping back in. When he played basketball by himself on the driveway, or when he played with friends at recess, he really enjoyed it. He just was playing. But when it became this heavy-handed, competitive thing that he had to always serve, it made him really unhappy. You know, and I think any parent who has kids that are going through something difficult knows that pain, right, of watching your child struggle with something that isn't making them happy. And on one hand, it was hard, right, because, I believed in the power of sports. I believed in the camaraderie that happens when you play a team sport. I believed in the physical activity. I believed in coming home sweaty and hot and tired and taking a shower and going to bed. And the fact that, no matter what we fed him, he would always, you know, have a healthy body. But at the same time, I saw that he just simply wasn't happy. And, you know, and I would sit at game after game and watch these tournaments go on for so long and observe that there was this entire sort of industrial complex that surrounded youth sports. I thought, something about this doesn't seem right. It seems like it's a perversion of that original idea that sports is supposed to be about a healthy mind and body and camaraderie among other people. It seemed more about, you know, sort of gaining some kind of abstract competitive advantage. So finally, you know, we're driving home from his final tournament, and I say to Galen, like, I don't think that you're happy. I don't think that this is something that you really like. And he says, well, I've got to do it. I've got to play basketball. I've got to have something or else I'm going to be a nobody. And it was finally when he said that I said, you know, I think we can think about this a different way. I think we can go a different way. And we don't always have to serve this big competitive machine quite as much. There's lots of ways to be active and to enjoy a sport and to have fun and to be healthy without always having to go in for something quite so crazy. And, you know, and in the time since, we've tried to encourage him to be a bit more, I guess the word I would use is peripatetic, you know, more diverse, to try out this sport and that sport. And he ran cross country with his junior high, and he does diving, and he likes to do skiing. He joined the ski club. And it's having the chance to try out different things and to not get so sucked into just one that has allowed him to have a sense of freedom and has restored some of that feeling of sports as fun, sports as fostering camaraderie, and sports is promoting a kind of healthy, active mind and body.
Right. As you tell this story in your book, and of course we get a cue from the title of the chapter, which is the cue word, you write at one point, I'd been afraid to utter the cue word even to myself. And I think you're really touching on something so profound there that on the most sort of superficial level, we talk often in such deprecating terms about quitting. It's no good to quit. You need to stick with it. And sometimes quitting is the very best choice. It's the wisest thing you can do. And yet we have to kind of shake ourselves loose from some of the presumptions that we make about quitting and whether or not it's ever okay to quit. And, I mean, the big moral of this story is sometimes that's exactly what you should do.
Yeah. I'm a really awful quitter, you know, and sometimes that sounds like a facetious thing to say. But, you know, I swam for a long time in which I felt really tired and wanted to just, you know, wished a meteorite would come down and sort of, kill us all so I could quit swimming. and that never happened, right? I just had to endure. And that translated into my working life, you know. I mean, anyone who's ever written a book knows that you go through these long periods in which you just are lost. And it's really tempting to want to just push it away and never look at it again, and you have to just kind of keep going back to it. And so it was very hard for me to think maybe the right thing to do is to just let go, to just sort of get out of the way and sort of back away from this. But once I finally did, and once I sort of, you know, I finally did utter those words and broach the idea with Galen, I could tell it was the right decision because he seemed to calm down pretty quickly. And he hasn't really looked back in the couple of years since he stopped playing basketball. And he still plays with his friends. He still likes the game in a lot of ways. But by backing away from some of that kind of crazy competition, I realized that I was giving him something that was better. And, you know, in some ways, like, we can sort of tie into the very beginning of this conversation. You know, this is one of those things that is part of the endlessly moving target that makes up fatherhood, you know. So much of me is oriented to the idea that I need to teach my boys how to persevere, how to handle failure, and to keep going in the face of defeat. And when I got to a moment at which that was really front and center, it turned out that the right decision was not perseverance, but changing course. And that was a hard lesson to learn, but that's what made it such an important one to learn.
Right. We're speaking with David McGlynn about his book, One Day You'll Thank Me, Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Of course.
Thank you. I want to turn ourselves backward time-wise and talk about you as a youngster growing up in a home that was eventually a broken home. Thanks to your parents' divorce. I wonder if you could say a word about the experience of having a father who at one point, once there had been this divorce, was not always there, and the longing that you had for him, which you tell us at one point is, in a sense, very similar to what was your preoccupation with the notion of fatherhood itself.
Yeah, you know, so that's another great question. So my parents divorced when I was 12, and, you know, they had been separated for a number of months, and so by the time the divorce actually came through, my father had been looking for another job for a while. But nevertheless, you know, we lived in Houston, Texas. The divorce comes through at the end of the summer when I'm 12. And then by Halloween, he's packing up and he's moving to Southern California, which is where he still lives. He took another job, and off he goes. And he soon gets remarried and has this whole other life 1,500 miles away from where we lived in Texas. And he and I had long been, even as a young kid, really close. And it was really painful for me for him to go. And I know because, you know, we talked many times over the years, it was also very painful for him, you know. And I think it's one of the things that he still looks back on as a really difficult time in his life. So we did our best. You know, sometimes circumstances required that hard decisions get made, and he had to go. And so he was always willing to talk to me. And this is sort of one of the first stories that gets told in the book. Whenever I would call, he would answer the phone. That was one of the deals that we had with each other. And I often would call, collect from a payphone somewhere, you know, off in my neighborhood, and he would take the number down and call me back, and we would talk, you know. And sometimes those conversations were only a few minutes, and sometimes they were a half an hour or even an hour long. And weirdly, you know, I felt like those moments on the phone were moments in which I had his undivided attention, and I would hang on them. You know, his voice, you know, had such a profound influence on me just because it would feel as though the rest of the world would fall away, you know. And as I turned from being a 12-year-old to an early teenager to a middle teenager to, you know, getting ready to go to college, those conversations continued. And I felt like each one, you know, as you sort of add them up, it was a sort of kind of life lessons in growing up told through telephone conversations a little bit at a time and punctuated with visits to see him in California and to spend the summer out there and to go there for Christmas.
Hmm.
And it's the sort of smallness of those conversations that really captured me and in many ways influences the way that I think about these small moments with my own kids as encapsulating some moment in which fatherhood becomes crystallized for me.
Right. You write at one point, the so-called lessons of manhood that television and movies depict as being imparted during campouts and fishing trips and ball games with hair mussing and arms around shoulders were for me largely received at a payphone.
That's
where these moments were received in what you call at one point short piecemeal conversations. One of the things that you also go on to observe that is really interesting is how one aspect of your relationship with your father during this period is that you would confess to him certain mistakes you'd made that the typical kid would normally be desperate to hide from their parents. Can you explain a little bit about what would prompt you to be open with your father about your own mistakes and misdeeds? Was it that you weren't confessing these things to him in person, but rather over the phone, or was there something else going on?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both, right? The phone itself is wonderfully intimate, you know, and we can sometimes forget now because, you know, we talk on cell phones and texts and social media and all those kinds of things. You know, when you have a really clear phone connection and it's all you have, you know, you're not distracted by other things, there is something really intimate about it. In some ways, as intimate as a long car ride when you're listening to someone talk on the radio. And so that venue alone made it easier for me to talk because I didn't have to look him in the eye. And his voice was very patient, right? So there was this setup for me to talk about, you know, when things went wrong with a girl when I was dating, you know, as a high schooler, you know, and oftentimes your first dates as a young person go pretty horribly. And, you know, when I would sort of do something around the house, I mean, one time I broke the front door by shoving a broom handle through it and lied about it and confessed to him but wouldn't tell my mother about it. You know, the other side of it is that, you know, I really felt close to him. And loved him and still do, and I wanted to connect, and I had the very real sense that he wanted to connect with me, that, you know, one of the things that sort of is crystallized by the distance that was between us is that all the other things that sort of can muddy up the day-to-day relationship between a parent and a child, you know, scheduling and making lunch and driving to sports and getting clothes cleaned and the house cleaned and all that kind of stuff, all of that in many ways had fallen away. And all that we were trying to do was to use the time that we had to focus on knowing each other and connecting to each other and being there. You know, I would reach out and he wanted to receive it. And so I always felt very safe talking to him. And, you know, maybe it's just my own personality, but I often feel better when I process through whatever I was going through, when I would make a mistake or I'd struggle with something or, you know, a test would go badly or, you know, I'd be snared in some kind of lie or something that I had told at school. Hearing someone, you know, sort of patiently accept me for who I was and to tell me what to, how to understand myself was wonderfully restorative, and helped me to sort of settle down and reflect about what I had done and oftentimes, you know, sort of set things right. Again, to go back to whomever I had wronged and say I was sorry, to even tell my mother, you know, my father's own ex-wife, where I had gone wrong. So I think it was a combination of you know, kind of having this line in on the phone, but also my own desire to have a close connection with the person on the other end.
You talk about your mother as well in your book, not quite as much, I don't think, as you talk about your father, but
right.
we certainly hear something about her. And I especially wanted you to talk about an interesting observation you make about her in a chapter called Please Forgive My Spotless Home. First of all, you should probably explain that wonderful title to our listeners. And then talk about the observation that you make about the kind of home that your mom kept and the way in which you think there was at least a little bit of connection at some points between that and the end of her marriage.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, my mother and I are a lot alike, right? Probably, you know, even more than either of us is willing to admit, but she's always been an extraordinarily clean person, and it's one of the sort of great pleasures of going into her house. It's always immaculately well kept, and it smells good, and everything's in its proper place, and the sheets are always clean, and the floors are always vacuumed. And you know, my entire life we've had dogs. She still has two dogs, and you can't find even a strand of dog hair anywhere. Despite the fact that, you know, she's always had these big shedding kind of dogs. But, you know, when I was a kid, some of that could be a little bit burdensome. And one of the biggest things, I was just telling friends about this the other day, one of the biggest hang-ups that she had was that we always had to make our beds. And so I would wake up in the morning and she was, you know, just insistent that my bed get made right away. And as a little kid, you know, in elementary school, I remember her making the school bus wait while I not only made my bed, but made it to her standards, right, where the hospital corners were tucked tightly and the bedspread was pulled up and sort of crisply aligned. Because for her, it was an emblem of things being in their proper place, you know. And I do intimate in the book that some of that meticulousness didn't always make things quite so easy between she and my dad. But at the same time, you know, when the divorce, you know, became very real, she was all the more insistent that the house and the sort of, you know, the sort of physical manifestation of her life remain clearly and orderly arranged. And it means that, you know, as I do try to say, like, she never gave over to surrender. She never sort of said, I just can't do it anymore, you know. She was tough in that way. She was sort of stubbornly committed to the person that she was. And to this day, she sort of, you know, is someone who is sort of a very diligent, organized person, which is a quality that I have certainly inherited and have honestly come to admire. You know, and one of the things that, that chapter in the book explores is how I now have that same need to make sure that the house is clean. We live in a relatively small post-war 1947 house in Appleton. It's not very big. It's got sort of dinged up woodwork. It's got old cabinets in the kitchen. And the one thing that we can do to make it feel like it's a nice place to hang out is keep it clean, especially given how big and rowdy and messy the boys could be. And so I have spent many weekends, really scrubbing the place down because it's kind of built into me. I to this day can't sleep in an unmade bed. I got to make the bed every day. It's become a kind of Pavlovian response. And there have been moments in which I have felt like I have become too insistent on these things at the expense of spending time with the kids. You know, it's another one of those moving targets. You know, I want things to be clean and nice, but at the same time, sometimes they involve or require a sacrifice that I don't know is always the wisest one to make.
I want to just read one paragraph that you write about your mom and thinking about why she was the housekeeper that she was and how your own image of that has evolved a bit over time. You write, "During the divorce, the house stayed as pristine as a museum. At the time, I took her compulsive cleaning as an unwillingness to accept the sordid state of her life, the fact that she and Dad had bottomed out. I thought her too concerned with the optics of respectability, and I accused her, sometimes venomously, of being shallow and materialistic. Years later, I could finally see her differently. When I recalled her Windexing the bathroom mirror with one hand while applying her makeup with the other, I saw her wishing she could undo her mistakes, hers and my dad's, and return them both to a former unblemished state. I also saw her finding the courage to move forward in the wake of what she couldn't repair. When the dust of the divorce finally settled, both my parents were deeply in debt and the mortgage was underwater, but no matter how bad things got, my mother never once called in sick for work or spent the day in bed with the curtains drawn." It's cool that you've come to some kind of newer and sort of deeper understanding of your mother and who she was and of all that she was contending with at that point in time.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think most people, most human beings, right, go through this moment, and probably more than one, where we see our parents as human, you know. And sometimes it happens when you're a teenager, and sometimes it happens later in life, and it oftentimes happens at every point along the way, you know. And you see that your parents are flawed, that they're vulnerable, that they haven't always done the right things. They didn't always have their own or even your best interests in mind. And that's just the sort of nature of it. One of the victorious things, one of the sort of great moments, is when you look back and that you see that your parent was tough. You know, and that's one of the things that I sort of see when I look back at my mom. You know, there are lots of ways in which I can see that she was human and flawed. But it's also, in some ways, sweet to look back and see that she has always been strong. And she has never been someone that surrendered very easily, and at least not without a pretty vigorous fight. And I do hope that, when she reads this portion of the book, and she's certainly read the article that inspires it, but I do hope that she sees, my admiration for her having those qualities. She was always very insistent when we were kids, my sister and I, that we would do our very best work, whatever that would be, whether it was in swimming, my sister swam as well, or school or whatever job we had at the time. We would never bring what she called our bare minimum to that task. We would always do our very best work. And that's a quality that I have not only inherited, but one that I really come to value as a parent. When you do something, do it to the best of your ability and give it all that you have. Because even if you don't succeed, it'll make you into someone better. It'll teach you something, and that alone is valuable. And I get that very much from her.
In our last couple minutes, I want us to at least touch on one very strong theme in the book, which is your two sons, Hayden and Galen, two great young men, but who like to fight, who have fought each other quite a lot and occasionally others as well. You say at one point, my boy's penchant for battle may not be fueled by testosterone, but is undoubtedly biological in another more specific way. As my sons, they're the descendants of a long line of fighters. So I appreciate the fact that you write about this as openly as you do, and you dispense a few lessons along the way as well.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they are from a long line of fighters. You know, we come from a sort of, you know, rambunctious Irish family. You know, my wife's side of the family is Scottish, and so, you know, these sort of great arguments that have played out over holidays, you know, they go back a long way. The boys, you know, I should mention, because we haven't mentioned this so far, are only 2 years apart, and they're not all that different in size. Galen right now has grown, and so he's, you know, quite a few inches taller than his brother. But for most of the time that they've been growing up, they've been relatively equally matched. And so one boy's attempt to dominate the other or to take what he wants from the other has been met with pretty fierce resistance. And so they really can squabble. And they're in each other's lives. They're in each other's bedrooms. They sometimes wear each other's clothes. You know, they have to share the back seat of every car trip. I mean, there's something about being a kid and having a brother in which this other person is constantly in your space, you know. And you see how this sort of plays out between them, where they're sort of always trying to, like, one-up each other. And sometimes it's physical, right? It's just a pure knockdown, drag out, go in the backyard or move the coffee table in the living room and have it out kind of fight. Sometimes there's more subterfuge and tradecraft involved. You know, someone takes one boy takes the other boy's dollar from his wallet, and so the other one tries to flush the other one's underwear down the toilet, and I've got to, you know, snake that out of the commode. But they do fight quite a lot, you know. And one of the lessons that I try to learn from that is, you know, I don't want to encourage them to be these fighters. At the same time, you know, you sort of have to roll with the tide as best you can. And so this is one of those sort of, you know, funny moments that, you know, probably is on the line of being not always so appropriate. But at a certain point, I got so sick of it that I said, okay, that's it. And we sort of moved all the furniture away, and I had them take off their shirts and shake hands and just fight it out. That chapter, though, is also sort of counterpointed with the fact that my wife and I have had our own share of arguments, and this is in many ways where the book kind of comes to a head. You know, it was a series of arguments that couldn't be recovered from that finally swamped my parents' marriage, and I'm able to see in my own capacity to argue with my wife in front of the kids, which I think we all do from time to time, that if I don't pay attention to my own behavior, if I don't pay attention to my own words, the things that I say to other people, if I take those things for granted, they can come back to have consequences that could be really difficult, you know. And my wife and I have a really good marriage. I think she would say the same. But that doesn't mean we're not all vulnerable to things going awry. You know, and so, and probably what is the darkest moment in the book, and this is what I think is really a lot of humor. You know, we have this big argument that sort of rages all night long, and the kids are there to watch it. And it's when I notice the kids watching us that I'm aware of the fact. I'm sort of recalled or brought back to those moments when I was a kid and I watched my parents not only fight but fight their way toward divorce. You know, and it stops me. This has to stop. I can't go on in this way. So I try to use that funny moment to make a sort of deeper and more sentimental point that, you know, we have to attend to each other. We have to apologize. We have to forgive each other, and we have to try to love each other as best we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one thing I love about the book: the deft mixture of humor and poignancy. And you really have achieved something very, very special indeed. I really love the book, start to finish. And again, it's titled One Day You'll Thank Me, Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood, published by Counterpoint, and the author, David McGlynn. David McGlynn, thank you for writing such a great book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I have profoundly enjoyed this.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert will be joining us, along with the leader of Root Pike.